Today is Monday, December 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As the coronavirus vaccine begins to be administered, officials warn tougher restrictions are coming to Germany and possibly elsewhere. Plus, will going the extra mile be enough to reach a Brexit deal?
The outstanding issues of fair competition rules, mechanisms for resolving future disputes, and fishing rights remain unresolved.
And some good beats to start your week. We'll have these stories and more next. As more countries approve the coronavirus vaccine, the urgent need for inoculation continues to grow, with COVID-19 cases and deaths spiking to record highs in several countries. The Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency said on Sunday that South Korea recorded a record daily increase in coronavirus cases for a second straight day, with 1,030 new infections. South Korean President Moon Jae-in warned on Sunday that COVID-19 restrictions may be raised to the highest level as the country battles a harsh third wave of infection.
It's a very serious and emergency situation. There is nowhere to back down. It is a desperate time to devote all efforts to stop the spread of corona by focusing all quarantine capabilities and administrative power. Unless the outbreak can be contained now, it has come to a critical point to consider escalating the social distancing measures to the third level.
In the U.S. last week, California recorded more than 25,000 new infections in a single day. California Governor Gavin Newsom said, "Lives will be lost unless we do more than we've done before." Overall, more than 16 million people in the U.S. have contracted the disease, while nearly 300,000 have died. A New York Times investigation found that coronavirus deaths have risen faster than the rest of the country in U.S. college town communities, where students make up at least 10% of the population. Italy is also poised to overtake Britain as the European country with the most COVID-19 deaths, according to data from Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, which also counts more than 71 million global COVID-19 infections and 1.6 million deaths. On Sunday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said a new lockdown is necessary because lighter measures to curb the spread of the coronavirus didn't work well enough.
Ich hätte mir auch gewünscht, dass die leichteren Maßnahmen
I also wish the lighter measures had worked better. We sat here and said we need a reduction in contacts of 70 or 75%. We only achieved 40% at best. And now, due to Christmas shopping, the number of social contacts has risen considerably. That means we must implement these measures. They will have a broad impact on many, many people. We are aware of that. But they will have an effect to stop our health system from being overwhelmed.
All non-essential retail will be closed, as will hair salons and schools, and employers are asked to close operations or have employees work from home. The sale of fireworks will be banned ahead of New Year's Eve. Germany has been in partial lockdown for 6 weeks, with bars and restaurants closed while stores and schools have remained open. With 3 weeks left to go and still no deal in sight, both British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen ditched a self-imposed deadline on reaching a Brexit trade agreement. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers has those details.
After a phone call with the UK leader, von der Leyen explained that despite the deadlock, they both agreed on one thing.
We both think that it is responsible at this point in time to go the extra mile.
The outstanding issues of fair competition rules, mechanisms for resolving future disputes, and fishing rights remain unresolved. Johnson said the most likely outcome was that the two sides wouldn't reach a deal and that they would both have to revert to Plan B.
The most likely thing now is, of course, that we have to get ready for WTO terms, Australia term.
With hundreds of thousands of jobs and tens of billions in trade at stake, Britons like Londoner John O'Sullivan are hoping for an end to the uncertainty.
People are getting absolutely brassed off with it all.
Karen Chamas, London.
U.S. President Donald Trump continued to hold out hope on Sunday that he won his re-election bid last month, a day before the Electoral College meets to formally pick Democrat Joe Biden as America's 46th president. Conservative groups claiming without evidence that the November 3rd election was stolen from President Trump staged protests across the country on Saturday, with one in Washington turning violent at times. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit backed by President Trump to overturn Joe Biden's election victory, ending a desperate attempt to get legal issues that state and federal judges had rejected before the nation's highest court. Joe Paul is a constitutional law professor at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, and we began our conversation by having Professor Paul explain the court's ruling.
So the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is primarily as an appellate-level court. It only hears appeals, except in cases that are brought by one state against another state. So this was a case brought by Texas, and the state of Texas was making the argument here that they were somehow injured by the way in which the other states conducted their election. And what the Supreme Court decided in this case is that that argument on its face is just fallacious, that there is no actual cognizable injury suffered by the state of Texas. So the court, in denying standing, was basically saying there's no case here. There's no injury suffered by Texas. They have no right to come into court.
Now, the other piece of that is that Justices Alito and Thomas said that they would have at least allowed Texas to file the complaint, but would not grant other relief. What do you interpret those remarks to mean?
What essentially that means is that Thomas and Alito were agreeing with the majority of the other seven justices in the court, insofar as they were saying there's no case here. But they were saying that it's a technical matter because the Constitution says that states can bring cases directly to the Supreme Court without having to go through the appeal process, that they should have allowed the case to be filed, but then simply not granted any relief.
Thank you. And we're talking about states and standing. Now, both President Trump and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, have said that the fight is not over, and possibly they would look at filing a new lawsuit in the District of Columbia where the president resides to give him standing. But so many of the president's legal challenges have been rejected by courts. So what do you make out of this legal strategy?
Well, it doesn't make any sense. The cases have now been rejected by nearly 60 courts, including about 58 judges who are Republican appointees. The theory of the case is essentially a denial of objective truth that Biden won the election and a denial of the principle of democracy under the law. The courts have repeatedly found that there was no evidence of widespread fraud, and the Department of Justice found the same thing.
One last question. In the United States, the citizens do not directly vote for the president. Rather, they vote for what are called electors. And on Monday, December 14th, the electors are voting for the president of the United States. I was wondering, as a constitutional legal expert, can you kind of explain the process and if any challenges to those elector slates can be made?
Well, that's a great question. Basically, Monday, the electors will meet in the state capitals. They will sign ballots indicating the person to whom they are obliged by law to vote for. And those ballots will then be certified by the governor of the states. And they will be put in envelopes, and they will be mailed to the vice president, who is the president of the Senate. And what then happens is that on January 6th, there's a joint session of Congress. The envelopes will be open. The vice president will read out the ballots. They will be tabulated, and they will announce that Joe Biden has a majority of the votes. Now, members of the Senate or the House can object. But under the Electoral Vote Count Act, the law provides that if the electors have been certified, that is to say, if the election has been certified as valid by December 8, which has happened now for all of the states except for Hawaii, those electors are presumptively valid. And so unless a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate were to vote together to reject a slate of electors, those electors' votes will count. And since a majority of the House is dominated by Democrats, and it's not at all clear that a majority of Republicans in the Senate would vote to disallow any of the electoral votes, it's pretty clear that there's no way to avoid the result that the president-elect will be Joe Biden.
Joe Paul is a constitutional law professor at the UC Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UN agencies are calling for greater protection for Venezuelan refugees and migrants fleeing economic hardship and persecution. Lisa Schlein reports that Venezuelans are often in danger upon arrival in other nations.
Many of the 4.6 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants across Latin America and the Caribbean face multiple risks due to COVID-19, crime and human trafficking, impoverishment, and other threats. The UN Refugee Agency says Venezuelans most at risk are those fleeing increasingly desperate conditions in their country. Field assessments indicate approximately 500 to 700 people leave Venezuela every day. Baba Baluch, a spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, says borders across the region remain closed, forcing refugees to use routes where they are threatened by armed groups, smugglers, and traffickers.
This exposes them to heightened risk of violence, exploitation, and trafficking, having been faced with theft, extortion, violence, and abuse in transit and border zones during their journey to safety. As conditions inside Venezuela continue to deteriorate, many arrive in Colombia weak and in a state of poor nutrition, having faced impoverishment and hardship for many months.
The International Organization for Migration says that COVID-19 has hit Venezuelan refugees and migrants in the region particularly hard. IOM spokeswoman Angela Wells says the economic and social impact of the pandemic has been devastating for both the Venezuelans and the 17 countries where they are now.
The pressures due to the COVID-19 mobility restrictions and consequent socioeconomic decline have been compounded by the difficulties they face in regularizing their situations in host countries and fewer opportunities to pursue regular migration pathways. Decreased economic opportunities have put refugees and migrants at greater risk of eviction and hunger, while xenophobia and discrimination toward this population have been on the rise.
Under the so-called Quito process, which works to help and protect Venezuelan refugees and migrants, Latin American and Caribbean countries coordinate efforts to allow them to reach countries of asylum more safely. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A radio station run by women for women in Kandahar, Afghanistan, has been awarded the 2020 Reporters Without Borders Prize for Impact. VOA's Bejan Hamdard has that one.
Journalism and the fight for women's rights are two of the big reasons the staff of Radio Mirman goes on the air. Since female journalists founded the Kandahar station in 2011, the team has received threats and warnings from the Taliban and other militant groups. But still, they persist.
The southern provinces are a difficult place to work for journalists. It takes a lot of commitment and courage on the part of female journalists to work there.
Afghan journalist Rangina Anwari, who reports in the same region as Mirman's reporters, says working in a tribal area like Kandahar comes at a high price.
I have worked with Mirman for years. I know what women are going through. Lack of security, threats, safety concerns, and more. I am working here to raise awareness and increase the capacity of women working outside.
By reporting on key issues, the radio station gets authorities to listen by giving women's voices plenty of airtime.
When we get connected to the radio program, we ask questions and they provide the answers from authorities. These answers have helped us and brought a change to our lives. I've seen my friends do the same. They called the radio to talk about their cases and stories, and journalists shared the issues with authorities and asked for solutions, which is a huge change.
For the journalists at the station, the 2020 Reporters Without Borders Prize for Impact is recognition of their hard work.
But Merman Radio got the best news. An award from Reporters Without Borders is the best news the women received. Journalists at Merman Radio are happy that their hard work has paid off.
The leaders of Merman Radio says they face a long journey as they continue to enable women to play an active and effective role in the society. They say the impact award from Reporters Without Borders has strengthened their commitment to achieving that goal. For Azizullah Popal in Kandahar, Afghanistan, Behzhan Hamdard, VOA News.
In a virtual press encounter on Saturday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters in New York that the tragedy of COVID-19 also provides an unexpected opportunity for a reset, adding that coronavirus relief and recovering investments can spur a green transition.
Policies to strengthen societies to face pandemics or other shocks can be a catalyst for sustainability. Pandemic recovery and climate action must be two sides of the same coin. The two tests of leadership today is to show climate ambition, take climate action, mobilize climate finance, and demonstrate climate solidarity.
Asked about his message to member states, Guterres said that they need to work to promote carbon neutrality. In addition, the UN chief said that it is crucial that the incoming United States administration take a lead in climate actions. For millennia, the world's oceans have seemed too vast and too bountiful to harm or even threaten. But human-caused climate change, pollution, overfishing, and other factors are threatening the ocean's ecosystems, on which all of life ultimately depends. For the first part in our year-end series on the ocean, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with marine ecologist Jane Lubachenko, distinguished university professor at Oregon State University and former Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. She began by explaining why the current state of the oceans is grim as a result of climate change.
As a result of climate change, the ocean is higher, it's warmer, it holds less oxygen, and we are seeing more and more heat waves in the ocean.
And what are some of the consequences of those factors?
The consequences of those are multiple. We're seeing bleached coral reefs. We're seeing economically important species being challenged with the increased acidity in the ocean. The ocean is 30% more acidic than it was 100 years ago. But it's also being strongly affected by overfishing, by pollution, nutrient pollution and toxins, and plastic pollution. And finally, the ocean is being massively affected by development along the coastal margins and habitat destruction on the seafloor.
That's a huge problem for ocean creatures, both large and small.
And it's a big problem for people as well, because the health of our economies, the health of our societies, the availability of nutritious food are all dependent directly on the health of the ocean. The ocean is in trouble, and therefore so are we.
Every living thing is dependent on the ocean.
Yes, the ocean really is central to all of life on the planet. The ocean drives much of the weather systems on the planet. The ocean absorbs over 90% of the excess heat that we generate and has been really doing humanity a favor in keeping the planet from being even warmer than it might have been otherwise.
I'd like to know more about practical ways that climate change on the ocean affects people. For example, I'm told that when the ocean heats up, the fish move to cooler or deeper waters.
That has a very serious consequence for fishermen and women who might have to go much farther to catch what they would normally be catching just right off their coastlines. For people inland, they might think about their weather patterns that they experience even in the middle of a continent are strongly affected by the ocean and how warm the ocean is. The patterns that we see emerging in terms of more extreme storms, more floods, more droughts, more tropical cyclones that are more powerful and more destructive. All of those impacts on people through the climate system are in large part a function of what happens in the ocean that is in turn affected by how much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases we are putting into the atmosphere.
And what about Africa, which I know has more regular coastline than any other continent?
So the African continent has suffered many of the impacts of overuse, overexploitation, in particular, depleted fisheries, both from lack of adequate fishery management, but also from illegal fishing and from overfishing from foreign fleets, as is the case other places in the world. Which is one reason that I firmly believe in the importance of robust fishery management so that we can actually have our fish in the ocean, but have our fish on our plates too. We have ignored the benefits of healthy coastal and ocean ecosystems. And now we are realizing, only when we're losing them, how much we're losing.
Jane Lubachenko is a former Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. One of South Africa's hottest rising stars, Aubrey Kawana, is blazing a trail to make Zulu music and fashion a global trend. He recently released a new EP with stunning visuals to some of those songs. Host of Music Time in Africa, Heather Maxwell, joined the young artist in a virtual interview to learn more.
All right. Hi, Aubrey. How you doing?
I'm good, and you?
I'm fine. Where are you right now?
I'm actually in South Africa, Johannesburg. That's where I'm based.
So thanks for joining me. You have a new music video out that I think it was released November 25th, around there, 2020.
Yes, Ukis. In Zulu, we call it Ukis. Actually, the song embraces love. It's all about love. I actually recorded the song during lockdown. I was chilling with my girlfriend, so I was like, you know what? Before I start making music, can I have a young kiss or something? And she was like, okay, cool. And then that developed to a song.
All right, let's watch a little bit first, and we'll come back and talk some more. When I saw your music video for the first time on YouTube, Aubrey, I was looking at the comments, and the very first one that you pinned said something like 0% fancy car, 0% naked women. I also appreciate that about your video, but I wanted to hear from you. You know, why did you pin that specifically?
Well, I'm very cultured and I respect everyone that I work with, whether it's males or females. So I also have a kid. I wouldn't like to show any good girl on my music video, and because my kid will grow up and see that, so and she'll think that's okay. Understand? So I want to live by example, by all means, from where I'm coming from, for my kid also.
You sing about Zulu culture and community, and you sing in Zulu mostly, right?
Yes.
How do you render the fact that you want to sing in Zulu and stay true to Zulu, but you also want your music to go global, where you know that most listeners and viewers don't speak Zulu?
You know what's nice about that? Music is, I feel like it's its own language through the emotion and through how they portray the music or how it sounds. You relate to it.
I think I read also with an interview, someone asked you about how does it feel to be such a big star. And you said you don't really feel like that. You feel more like you're a messenger or a
yes.
pastor being sent to represent
yes.
your community.
Growing up, I never had someone to look up to or someone to motivate me or someone to say, yo, boy, relax. Whatever you're going through right now, this is not the end of it. You're going to get out of it and be a better person. So I'm trying to be that guy or that young boy for the guys that are coming up or for young people that are growing up.
So you went to school in fashion design. Yeah. And the music video Ukis, you have a wonderful sense of style. And the previous one, Molo, which has over 3 million views and it's only recently released. It's just a big hit. Let me see that beautiful necklace. What does it say?
It says Aubrey.
Okay. In silver?
Yes, that's my logo. I designed this logo. I do my own ad covers. I dress myself. I style myself. And I write my own music. And I produce my own, like, I record myself and I mix my own vocals. You understand? The only thing that I outsource is beats. So everything that I grew up doing, finally, it makes sense because it all came together and became one thing.
That must feel really great.
Hey, man, I feel like God had a plan. When God makes a plan for you, I feel like he, when it's time for that plan to shine, he makes sure that it shines.
It has been such a pleasure to talk to you, Aubrey. Juana.
Yes, thank you so much.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well. Be safe and have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For nearly 10 years, Syria has been abusing its people in the worst ways possible. The regime, led by Bashar al-Assad, has attacked peaceful protesters with tanks and guns. It dropped barrel bombs filled with gasoline and high explosives on its population and suffocated entire neighborhoods and villages with poison gas. Syrian citizens were maimed and tortured and killed by starvation and chemicals and fire. In Syria, civilians were not mere casualties of war, they were and still are targets. As a result, out of a pre-war population of 23 million people, around 500,000 have been killed. 6.5 million are internally displaced, while some 5.6 million are refugees in neighboring countries. But now Assad, the architect of these atrocities, is calling for the refugees to return to Syria. Echoing this demand is his supporter and enabler, Russian President Vladimir Putin. At a recent refugee conference co-hosted in Damascus by Syria and Russia, Assad and Putin insisted that civil war is over and that many areas of the largely shattered country are now at peace. At the same time, Russia insisted that reconstruction of the war-destroyed country must precede the return of Syrian refugees, claiming that refugees will only be able to go back home if the West is willing to pay to rebuild Syria. This is a blatant attempt by Russia to cash in by helping its companies snag lucrative reconstruction contracts. The refugees do not trust Assad's promises. Western countries are also not buying it and insist that reconstruction funds will be made available only when all political prisoners are released, the safety of all Syrians is guaranteed, and Syria's political progress is deemed to be legitimate. The Assad regime, with Russian backing, is seeking to use millions of vulnerable refugees as political pawns in an attempt to falsely claim that the Syrian conflict is over, said State Department Deputy Spokesman Cale Brown in a written statement. The Assad regime is responsible for the deaths of over 500,000 of its own citizens, the bombing of numerous hospitals, and the denial of humanitarian support to millions of Syrian citizens. These are not the actions of a government that can be trusted to determine when refugees might safely return, nor should Assad hold power over directing international reconstruction funds, he said. The United States remains committed to the Syrian people and to United Nations Security Council Resolution 2254, which is the only path to a political solution to the Syrian conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.